Welcome to The Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays, read by Leighton Pugh.
The Empires Strike Back. David Frum. From 9/11 until the Russian invasion of Crimea, the danger that chiefly preoccupied Western strategic thinkers came in the form of those perils presented by sub-state actors, terrorist networks above all. They worried less about the military balance between strong states than about the capacities of weak states. Now, states are back. Even today's deadliest terror groups aspire to function like states, as their very names tell us. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or Iraq and the Levant. They seek to hold and govern territory. They tax. They even purport to issue currency. Meanwhile, internationally recognized states have been challenging the international order ever more boldly. Iran, China, and above all, Russia. Russia followed its annexation of Crimea by an invasion of mainland Ukraine, launching the first great power military action on the European continent since 1945. Russia menaces other neighbors too, even wargaming nuclear attacks on their capitals. Strategic thinkers have been slow to wake up to this new reality of intensified challenges from state actors. Official thinking is always conservative, and academic thinking even more conservative than that. Yet it's not just aversion to change that explains the strong official and academic reluctance to face new realities. Four other powerful factors have been at work. First, sub-state actors did and do present a very genuine threat. Al-Qaeda and groups like it, from Nigeria to the Philippines, killed a great many people in the two decades after 1996. Had one of the more technically accomplished of these groups been able to obtain nuclear material from a state ally or on a black market, they could have killed many, many more. There was genuinely a lot to worry about. Second, while the threat from sub-state actors is genuinely frightening, it is also a threat of a character that many Western governments, the Obama administration heading the list, found more congenial to think about than threats from other states. The one thing that is not an answer to sub-state actors is a big and costly military. Even the most ambitious counter-terrorism effort is a bargain compared to a build-up of conventional forces. Third, in the United States especially, the debate over state and sub-state actors became a polemical battleground between the Bush administration and its critics. George W. Bush was accused of failing to prevent 9/11 because of under-attention to sub-state actors, and then stumbling in Iraq because of over-attention to state actors. The habit of slamming the Bush administration continued long after that administration itself left office. As the Obama administration bumped into foreign policy troubles of its own, polemics that had started life as anti-Bush attacks were repurposed as pro-Obama excuses. Fourth, and finally, not a few thinkers hoped that sub-state threats would provide a new justification for supra-state entities like the European Union and the United Nations. Terrorism knows no borders, European Commission First Vice President Frans Timmermans declared in a statement of April the 20th, 2016. Law enforcement officials in all our member states should think European and act European. The unwillingness to consider threats from state actors explained the surprise of Western policymakers at the Russian invasion of Crimea in February 2014. 48 hours before the invasion, the Obama administration was assuring members of Congress and briefing the press that it would not happen. Even as it happened, pro-administration sources cautioned journalists against believing what they saw. There is still a question about whether this is Russian troops coming across the border or Russian troops moving around the installations in Crimea, was the line issued by the administration. The paramount threat from the sub-state actor ISIS was cited by the Obama administration as one of the prime justifications for a nuclear deal with Iran, the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism. Yet, even as the president convinced himself that the Middle East was being reshaped by ISIS, the power of true states reasserted itself in the region and beyond. Iran extended its military reach from Herat to the borders of Israel, re-established its client Bashar al-Assad as the ruler of the most lucrative bits of Syria and Lebanon, and extracted recognition of its nuclear enrichment program from the United States. Meanwhile, Turkey divorced its foreign policy from its old NATO and EU alliances, working with Syrian Sunni insurgents against Assad and Iran, with Assad and Iran against the Kurds, and with just about anyone against Russia. It discovered a new lever of power over Germany in its ability to accelerate or slow the flow of Middle Eastern migrants to Europe, and in that power over Germany, it also found new resources to strengthen the authoritarian regime of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan against internal opponents. The migrant flow, in turn, jolted Germany into unilateral action, first opening its own borders, and thus the entire Schengen zone, then imposing quotas on bulky neighbours to share the duty for which Germany had volunteered them, without their consent. Unilateral German action sparked angry reaction in Hungary, Poland, and ultimately the United Kingdom, a referendum victory to quit the European Union that could well unravel both the EU and the UK too. The suprastate actors, supposedly empowered by transnational substate threats, instead found themselves weakened and discredited, none more so than the European Union, but also NATO and the US-led Pacific Coalition to contain China. Originally a US project, the Trans-Pacific Partnership stalled in Congress and was eventually opposed not only by the populist Republican nominee Donald Trump, but also by former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who had helped negotiate it and who had endorsed it in the hardcover edition of her memoirs, an endorsement excised from the paperback. The great post-war free trade agreements that brought so much prosperity across the Western world now stand accused and mistrusted by the nations they've enriched. Donald Trump campaigned as the most explicitly protectionist US presidential candidate since the Depression. The borderless world, predicted by the management guru Kenichi Ohmae in 1990, is yielding instead to a 21st century of egoistic states. Of states, but not of nations. The late 20th and early 21st century period has been one of mass migration on a scale never before seen in human history. Even the formerly most cohesive nation-states, Britain, Sweden, Portugal, have suddenly found themselves multi-ethnic and multicultural. The ensuing internal diversity has raised unprecedented security challenges, from outright terrorism to a surge in sexual crime to attacks on synagogues and Jewish schools. States have met these challenges by expanding the powers of police, by prolonging periods of detention, and by rebuilding the borders erased during more optimistic days. Thomas Jefferson said that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. The price of diversity, it seems, is enhanced surveillance. Europe and the world have had long experience with large multi-ethnic states. The Habsburg domains were such a state, so was the Tsarist realm, so too the Ottoman Empire, and so also, in a very different way, was the pre-1914 United States. Some of these states were highly effective, others less so. Some of these states had representative institutions, some were reasonably liberal, but none, including the US, with its denial of voting rights to the black minority in the South, would qualify as democracies by today's standards, even apart from their denial of voting rights to women. These states may not have been imperialist in the sense of seeking more territory. The Ottomans regarded it as a good year if they could manage to hold on to what they already had. But they were imperial in the sense of not being national. Is this the future of the West? Is it already the present? Theorists of monetary policy refer to an impossible triangle, the inescapable fact that any monetary system can do at most two or three things a policymaker would want money to do. Money can be traded freely, it can be stable in its value relative to other currencies, or it can respond independently to local economic conditions. Never all three. Likewise, an impossible triangle of state organization seems to be emerging. The dream of a world made up of states that had left behind their own distinctive national character, that were lightly internally policed, and that freely ceded much of their sovereignty to international organizations, is a fading one. The supranationalism we see is a supranationalism within state boundaries, guided by increasingly assertive state interest. As our world becomes less national, it seems also to become less liberal. This outcome has surprised many modern people. We are used to thinking of nationalism as the enemy of freedom and individuality. But there was a time when nationalism and liberalism proceeded together, and although that time was long ago, that bygone era has lessons for our time that deserve attention, along with the grimmer 20th century experience. Today, governments in Switzerland, Sweden, Denmark, Austria, and Germany are painstakingly seeking to impose standards of behaviour on new immigrants. These standards are sometimes ludicrously specific, sometimes troublingly intrusive, often both. One can flunk a citizenship test by declining to swim alongside members of the opposite sex, or by expressing an incorrect opinion about gay marriage on a written questionnaire. These states are attempting to identify and exclude would-be newcomers too alien to be absorbed into a national community. But the attempt to write into formal bureaucratic practice the unwritten expectations and assumptions of a community will both A. rapidly descend into farcical failure, and B. transform what was experienced as natural, just the way we do things, into an external compulsion. A nation-state's cultural norms don't require police. There's no fine in the United Kingdom if you don't stand still at 11:11 on November the 11th during the minute of silence. Only shame. A post-national state's cultural norms do not self-enforce. Hence the bizarre tutorials for new immigrants on how not to rape women that have spread across Northern Europe in the wake of the sex attacks in Cologne on January 1, 2016. What was implicit must be made explicit. What was voluntary must become mandatory. What feels to co-nationals, like the freedom to be yourself, will feel to non-nationals like a denial of their identity and the forcible imposition of another. Sub-state enemies of post-national states will attempt to recruit alienated citizens as combatants against the societies in which they hold formal but not emotional membership. Whereas it used to be hoped that supranational entities could defeat sub-state terrorism, it looks at least equally true that post-national states are uniquely liable to spawn and be preyed upon by sub-state terrorism. Strongly national states are not immune to terrorist political violence. Remember Om Shinrikyo in Japan. But they are less vulnerable than states that are home to large restive ethnic minorities. Belgium, France, Sweden. Strongly national states may be conformist, think Japan again, but they don't have to deploy their military to patrol their cities or protect houses of worship. But this is our world, a world of states that are strong and effective, but internally divided, whose leaders are elected, but whose governments must accept that large elements of their population withhold their consent from the authorities that rule them. A world of failing superstates, in which states act autonomously and selfishly, first against substate dangers, and then against other states doing the same. It's not where we hope to be in those giddy days after 1989, but history is full of surprises. Most of them nasty.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.